In the years since the United States' invasion of Iraq, the Christian population there has declined dramatically from 1.5 million in 2003 to fewer than 500,000 today. And the fate of the Christians who've remained is at best uncertain. The rise of extremist groups like ISIS means that religious minorities of all kinds, including a diverse Christian community, are under constant threat, and many of those who have been able to escape Iraq are choosing to flee the Middle East altogether. Communities and traditions that have existed for thousands of years could disappear in a generation. Eliza Griswold has written about the plight of the Middle East Christians for the New York Times. She's also the author of The 10th Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. She was here to talk about that. How long ago? A year and a half ago or so?
Mm-hmm. And then you had me back to talk about some Afghan folk poems.
And now, welcome back to our show.
Thank you.
ISIS now controls an area roughly the size of Indiana. How aggressively has the group been targeting Christians in particular?
They target all minorities with as much zeal as they can muster. Now, with the Christians, so the largest population, the largest minority they've targeted, of course, we've heard about the Yazidis. And we've heard about President Obama launching airstrikes to protect a possible genocide against the Yazidis on a mountain. And so we've heard about the Yazidis, and we've heard far less about the Christians. And the Christians are targeted just as aggressively. There are things ISIS says about Christians, you know, as fellow people of the book. Oh, we're going to protect you. Oh, you're going to be able to pay this tax. And the truth on the ground, as I've talked to survivors, is very much that is not true.
Well, the tax is called the jizya.
That's exactly right.
And how much is it?
You know, I have not met anyone who's agreed to pay it, so I'm not quite sure. But one of the most interesting things is that ISIS now has, you know, their own propaganda, and they have a video called Until There Came Clear Evidence, and they have shopkeepers. It looks like CNN shot it, and it's shopkeepers from Raqqa, Christian shopkeepers, you know, a bicycle repairman talking about, oh, well, they'll really let you stay if you pay this tax.
Does that apply to all the minorities, the Shia, the Kurds, the Yazidis, the Zoroastrians, the Jews, as well as the Christians?
It would, in theory, it would. So if it really applies, it would, in theory, apply to the Zoroastrians and the Jews, because they would be considered fellow people of the book, meaning that they're named in the Quran as monotheists. The Yazidis, who are not within that group, are especially targeted. They're practically, a Yazidi could be enslaved. A Yazidi man could be killed. But the truth is, when you look carefully at what ISIS is writing, the same is true for every other minority group.
So are we talking about all of the horrors that we've been reading about, crucifixions as punishment, beheadings, kidnappings, slavery for all of these groups?
Absolutely across the board.
Your article opens with a story of a Christian woman named Dia who stayed behind with her husband in the city of Karakoş, is it?
The husband's name is Dia. The town is Karakoş. It's a town of 50,000, and until recently it was the largest Christian city in Iraq. And her name is Rana.
How did they get stuck there?
Well, it depends if whose family you ask. If you ask the husband's family, he'll give you one answer. If you ask Rana's family, her family will give you another. Essentially, they got stuck because there were many times at which it looked like ISIS would take the city, and ISIS hadn't taken the city, and Dia refused to leave. He was tired of running.
You describe a terrifying scene where the people who remained in Karakoş are divided into separate groups by ISIS and then loaded into buses. What happens then?
You know, this reporting was really challenging because no one knew about these buses. And so what I was doing at first is looking for survivors who had somehow escaped from this town because I wanted to know what happened when ISIS took it over. And very slowly it came out that there had been essentially in late August, ISIS had rounded up the people who were still in the town, 100-some people, by survivors' accounts, and they had called them to the medical center in town. And when they got to the medical center, they had separated them into men and women. They had searched them. And those searches, which were called medical checkups, were really really robbery, right? They were looking for valuables. And that's one reason Rana was especially frightened, because according to her brothers, her husband had made her carry the valuables for the family. She told her brothers over the phone when they spoke, because from captivity, her ISIS captor allowed her to speak to her family three times. She told her brother that ISIS had searched her twice. Whether or not that means more than searching, her family didn't ask. They didn't want her to answer questions that might get her into trouble.
What finally happened to Dia and Rana?
Finally, Dia and Rana were taken. So when those buses were split, it was about 7 in the morning when everybody gathered at this medical center. It was an incredibly hot day. The summers in Karakosh, as in most of Iraq, you know, top 110 degrees. Slowly, some of the people in the crowd realized that ISIS was separating the younger and healthier people, meaning those who looked maybe under 50, from the older and sicker people. And the older and sicker were sent to the first bus, and they were sent out of ISIS territory. They were exiled. And the others, Dia and Rana, were taken into captivity where they still are today.
And you also write about a small girl named Christina. Why would, what does ISIS want with small children?
You know, this is absolutely one, if not the most disturbing aspect of what they do. They take children. Children become some kind of PR mascot for them. You know, there's the idea of saving a child by taking her into the Islamic State. You know, the rape of young Yazidi girls is well documented. There are still several thousand in captivity. When I was doing this reporting, one Yazidi father who had bought every single member, every single child from his family back out of captivity, showed me photos that ISIS had sent him on WhatsApp of his own 2-year-old son dressed like ISIS, going to school under ISIS in tiny fatigues. It's a propaganda move, and it's a move to, you know, they're all about what appears on the internet. This is a virtual community, and those pictures go far and wide quickly.
There's been there's a recent documentary in which a scene shows members of ISIS all joking about trading slaves.
Oh, sure. I mean, the only reason this Yazidi father was able to get his family back, and the only reason the one guy who's running this underground railroad out of ISIS territory was able to get people out, is they pose as fellow ISIS members, and ISIS sells slaves to one another.
ISIS, you said the film was very sophisticated. They really have put a lot of production value into their propaganda, despite the fact that they are totally critical of the West.
They have grown up with video games. And we see this, you know, they are a generation, they're a generation younger than I am, for sure. And not only do they put a lot of value into production value, but they also are of a different generation that's much savvier about such things.
Does the Iraqi government or do other governments do anything to counter that propaganda?
Probably the most vociferous attempt, or the hardest attempt to combat them, is our own, and we're not doing very well.
My guest is Eliza Griswold, whose article "Is This the End of Christianity in the Middle East?" appeared in the New York Times. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I should mention the other book that you had out recently, your book of Afghan folk poems, was "I Am the Beggar of the World," which won the 2015 Penn Prize. When we say Christians in Iraq, aren't we talking about a very diverse group of Christian beliefs?
That is such an essential question. What does it mean to be Christian? Christian isn't really a matter of religion or solely religion. It's an ethnic and historical identity that's 1,700 years old.
So these are different groups, mm-hmm, that all call themselves Christians, but they could disagree the same way that various Protestant groups and Catholics could disagree.
That's exactly right. They are, by matters of doctrine, largely, and liturgical differences.
And didn't some of these communities actually exist in Iraq before the birth of Jesus?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. I mean, we're looking at the Assyrian community, which goes by several different names. We're looking at ancient Mesopotamia. This is 5,000 years of history at the least.
When did where did most of them live? Were they all, did they all live in the northern part of Iraq?
That's a very good question. Most of the area I focused on are communities from the Nineveh Plain. So yes, that's the community that we're looking at, mostly displaced by ISIS now.
You write about some towns which once had thousands of residents and now are fairly empty. Where are the refugees going?
Well, they are going wherever they can. Largely, they're going to Kurdistan, to northern Iraq, which has been very, very generous about taking them in. They have no support now there because of UN funding. We're looking at, you know, people froze to death last winter. They were squatting in half-built malls. Now they're in refugee camps. That's on the Iraqi side of the border. When we look at Syria, we're looking at communities of Christians fleeing to both Lebanon and to Jordan primarily.
And they're leaving Syria because of ISIS again, or because Assad, to some degree, depicted himself as a supporter of minorities.
Exactly. This is one of the reasons that this human rights catastrophe hasn't gotten the attention that it might. These Christian communities have long been supporters of these brutal dictators, and in turn, the brutal dictators have protected them. That was true in Egypt with Mubarak. That was true in Iraq with Saddam Hussein. And that's still true in Syria with Assad.
Historically, didn't Muslim rulers treat their Christian minorities better than Christian leaders treated their Muslim populations in Europe?
That's certainly what I would say from my reading of history, but I've had readers respond saying that perhaps that's not fully accurate either.
Were Christian communities allowed to do business and to thrive?
They were absolutely allowed to function. Again, it was mostly a matter of paying the jizya tax. But yes, they could function. They could even do things that were forbidden for Muslims. They could eat pork. They could drink alcohol in their homes. Not universally, but at periods of history, yes, they could do such.
And that continued into the 20th century. When did things change?
Well, it depends on who you talk to when things changed. I mean, we could talk about periods into the 13th century that were extremely difficult. Tamerlan, you know, he killed hundreds of thousands of Christians. But then when we look at the genocide, what we call the Armenian Genocide 100 years ago, which was about nationalism and not about religion, the death toll for those who happened to be Christians, Armenians, Assyrians, Greeks, it was several million people were killed. Survivors either left the region or they went to Syria. And that's where the support for dictatorship began.
Religion and politics are often intertwined. For example, in Lebanon, the original constitution had a Maronite president and then a Muslim parliament.
That's exactly right. And that Lebanon—
I probably got that a little wrong, but something like that.
You know, I think you're absolutely right in the most important piece of it is that the Lebanese constitution continues to enshrine vibrant religious demography. And Lebanon, you know— if you ask a Lebanese politician today, he will most likely say, that's mostly who I talk to, would say, we came under criticism for the mixing of religion and politics. And now look at our system. Perhaps we are the model for what is to come.
Aren't Christian communities nearly non-existent in Iran and Turkey? I'm surprised about Turkey because it was once the seat of the Byzantine Empire.
Exactly. But the genocide really wiped out Christians from Turkey.
The genocide which went after Armenians.
Exactly, because those Armenians happened to be Christian as well.
Why did Christian communities and Middle East people who have roots there going back millennia suddenly become considered stand-ins for the West and the targets of violence?
Really, you know, my research would say that mostly that has been linked to the post-2003 invasion, that we've seen this happens, you know, this has really happened not just in Iraq and Syria. You could say Pakistan is a perfect example. The perception of a shared religion and the idea of an enemy near. Here, I cannot attack Barack Obama's White House, but I certainly can attack the church down the street.
But Pan-Arabism was largely a Christian movement, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
And that's not recognized by the Muslims who are now Pan-Arabists?
You know, Pan-Arabism has gotten a bad name. you know, among the resurgent. So what we're seeing here, what I would say what we're seeing, is we're seeing the breakdown of the nation state, right? Really across the region. So nations that began as arbitrarily colonial drawn borders no longer hold validity to people. And more than any other identity, the rise of identity attached to religion is the most important. So that is really the most common denominator now. We see that not only in the Middle East and North Africa, but in larger regions too.
As I understand it, most of the Christians in the area are as opposed to Israel as many of the Muslims are. So this could not be described as a kind of the same sort of thing we've seen with all the anger toward the West because of Israel.
This becomes a very tricky, again, when we look at why is no one taking up the cause of Middle Eastern Christians, we call them Eastern Christians, their lack of support for Israel is a very important factor, because although the Christian right has largely taken up this issue of persecution of fellow believers, because the Eastern Christians support Palestinian Christians over the idea of Israel, they don't find the support that they might.
So American evangelicals whose beliefs are tied up with the idea that Israel has to survive and that eventually that's going to lead to the second coming.
Exactly. If the temple doors cannot open, if Israel doesn't exist and the temple doors cannot open, then the second coming is at risk.
You write that Ted Cruz recently astonished Middle Eastern Christians. What did he do?
He
admonished them, I mean.
Well, yeah, I bet he had astonished them before he admonished them. He showed up at he was the guest speaker at an event for Lebanese Christians called In Defense of Christians. And he got up on stage and scolded them, saying, you know, you guys should see your best friend as Israel. And he was booed. That's what happened to Ted Cruz.
What's President Obama's position been on all of this?
You know, his position is, first of all, extremely complicated because he can't risk playing into ISIS, right? The hands of ISIS saying, oh, look at the crusading West defending its fellow Christians. And he also doesn't want to fall into the hands of the Christian right by talking about persecution. He has explicitly mentioned the risks that Iraqi Christians are facing. But, you know, I would say that the Iraqi Christian community, as well as the Syrians, as well as the larger community of Eastern Christians, would like to see him do and say more on their behalf.
I'm speaking with Eliza Griswold, whose article in the New York Times was, Is This the End of Christianity in the Middle East? She's also the author of The 10th Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam, and also I Am the Beggar of the World, which is a collection of Afghan folk poems. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Eliza Griswold. Her article, Is This the End of Christianity in the Middle East?, appeared in the New York Times and created a bit of a stir. Why would it create a stir?
You know, it created a stir, I would guess. Well, first of all, this is an article a lot of people have been waiting for somebody to write. Right. I mean, this is an issue that's gone unaddressed for a long time.
And listeners write into me and ask me every so often, why isn't this being discussed more?
Yeah. I've been watching this issue as a reporter for a long time. And, you know, it takes some courage to wade into it because you can be pretty sure if you do a good job, you're going to make everybody angry. You know, this is a human rights crisis and a human rights cause that has been orphaned by both the left and the right. And it's not just a matter of Christianity. It's a matter of plurality and the future of the Middle East. And that's really what interested me. And I hope that comes across in the article.
In talking about Middle Eastern Christians, isn't it important to avoid a clash of civilizations narrative? But since 2003, the United States has invaded or conducted airstrikes against Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, Libya. Surely our image couldn't get any worse in the area.
All right. So this is the challenge. How do you start using the word Christians without falling into the very pitfalls that President Obama is doing his absolute best to avoid, right?
And being criticized for it.
And being criticized. He's being criticized for avoiding the issue, and groups like ISIS are just waiting for him to step into the issue.
Did the Arab Spring change the way that any people in the region or that Christians in the regions were being treated?
Absolutely. The Arab Spring made things much, much worse. And it's interesting because I was talking to an activist, an Assyrian Christian activist who lives in Norway, and I was saying, oh, you know, when the Arab Spring began, we in the United States, we were so excited. You know, here's this plural moment. What will rise? He said, we weren't excited. We understood from the beginning what was going to face us.
Coptic Christians in Egypt have been targeted.
Coptic Christians in Egypt have been targeted for hundreds of years. Now, one of the curious, and I wish I'd had space to get into this in the piece, one of the very curious things that happened, Coptic Christians have long sort of marginalized themselves because they've been an embattled minority in order to protect themselves. With the uprisings in Egypt, Christian youth took to the streets, and it led to a new unity between Christian and Muslim youth. Of course, with the rise of Islamist groups, the Coptic minority has been very much beaten up.
Although the Muslim Brotherhood came to the defense of the Coptics when they were being attacked.
Absolutely.
Now, many Christians are leaving the Middle East. Where are they going?
They are going anywhere they can. Traditionally, they like to go to the United States, and they like to go to Australia and Europe. So they're doing their best to get to those places.
And what's the situation for visas in the West?
The visa situation in the United States is beyond dismal. Now, okay, so if we get into numbers there, it is very true that, you know, Ambassador at Large for Religious Freedom, David Saperstein, pointed out to me that of the hundred and some thousand refugees we've taken in from Iraq, about 40% of them are minorities, right? Are religious minorities. So we're not doing terribly with Iraq. On Syria, we are doing dismally. I think the latest count, and again, I didn't have room to get into this in the piece, but in formal reporting, I think we're looking at less than 1,000 refugees that we've taken in from a war that's displaced millions of people.
And there's an underground railroad to help people escape ISIS?
Yes, absolutely.
Where
there are
they
several.
Going?
Those guys, so there are several of these underground railroads. The one that I reported on most in depth is run by a businessman who's in northern Iraq, and that's the best he can do. He can't even get himself out of northern Iraq, but he can get people out of ISIS territory to Ankawa, the Christian suburb right outside of Erbil, the capital of northern Iraq.
When they go to the Kurdish area, aren't they under the threat now of Turkish attacks? This has been a big shock for the United States, I think, that the Turks, who seem to be joining us in the fight against ISIS, actually are using this as an excuse to attack Kurds.
Yeah, not in Kurdistan itself. Now, but this is so important because, okay, so the minorities, not just the Christians, but the Yazidis, the Turkmen Shia, all the minorities want a right to remain in their homeland. But in order to get that right to remain in their homeland, northern Iraq, the Kurds, would have to have some kind of right to self-rule. Northern Iraq cannot get – the Kurds can't get that right to self-rule because they can't get support from the United States because of Turkey, right? So we're watching these very sensitive tectonic plates that are kind of stuck.
Also because we're concerned about how Baghdad would respond to an independent Kurdish province. There's a lot of oil to be considered as well.
There's a lot of oil. And the Nineveh Plain, this area where the Christians and the Yazidis and other minorities have traditionally been, especially these Assyrian communities, this has long been a tug of war between the Arabs and the Kurds in the north.
One of the main escape routes for Christians out of the Middle East runs through Lebanon. Is that because Lebanon has had a stronger Christian minority? Haven't the Christians been leaving Lebanon as well?
The Christians have been leaving Lebanon as well, and Lebanon is the only country in the region where Christians have an active role in the government.
Have they been playing a role in buffering the Sunni-Shia divide in that country?
Yes, they absolutely have. And that's one of the ways in which – so Christians play this role between the deepening Sunni-Shia divide as a political and social buffer. Again, it's less about being Christian and it's more about minority status, what a vibrant minority community represents.
Are these minorities caught in the middle between the Sunni-Shia battle?
Yes, in that the worsening security situation means that they are more vulnerable to attack. Also, in Lebanon, which is fascinating, Hezbollah has been making inroads into Christian communities, even paying Christian young men to go fight. So we're seeing the idea being that the Shia, who are a minority within the larger region, want to create or may want to create an alliance of minorities, and the Christians could play a role in that.
So they're sending them to fight in Syria?
They're sending them to fight in Syria, yes.
President Assad of Syria recently admitted that he's running low on manpower and will have to pull back from certain key areas. What will happen if he falls?
Oh, my gosh. You know, reporting on Syria, just I'm afraid that Syria will be President Obama's black eye. You know, and I'm afraid that we are going to see that in the future. If he falls, anything is better than Assad.
Well, there was that red line that the president said he wouldn't allow Assad to cross, and then Assad crossed it, and he didn't do anything about it, and he's been criticized for that. But there'll be a total disaster if Assad falls, even though Assad is a terrible dictator.
Syria is a total disaster. With Assad, you know, I would say it could only get better. You know, there have been so many missteps and lack of engagement from the Obama administration on Syria, even saying that there was no vibrant community of moderates. That was just not true.
Is that why we are more willing to open up relations with Iran right now?
To help in Syria?
Mm-hmm. You write about President Obama's willingness to support Iran as a bulwark against Sunni extremism.
Yes, that's absolutely true. My fear, based on my reporting and listening to the people of Lebanon, is that as a result of the Iran deal, President Obama, the United States will essentially hand Lebanon to Syria once again. And if any part of this Iran deal serves to shore up the power of Assad, we're in absolute trouble. Now, I don't think it will. I think what we'll see is a negotiated departure for Assad, and that's the language we're starting to hear.
And then who would run Syria?
You know, that's
a... Because ISIS would probably continue fighting because it wants to take over that whole area.
We're looking at a future for ISIS probably about a decade of ISIS. The ISIS is not going away anytime soon. We're seeing the Secretary of State, we're seeing John Kerry reach out and talk about minorities, maybe to think about what would be a role for the Alawites post-Assad.
One person you interviewed compared the situation to Game of Thrones. In what way?
Well, she is just a remarkable, just badass young journalist. But she was talking about a particular battle called the Battle of Kalamun, which was being waged between Hezbollah and ISIS, essentially. But the larger point there, she was talking about waiting for the snow to melt. But what we're seeing here is shifting tectonic plates of power, right? One thing that I find fascinating as a reporter is that the idea of Israel as kind of the engendering conflict of the region, over. Sunni-Shia divide is a much more important power nexus now than any other.
My guest is Eliza Griswold, whose article is This the End of Christianity in the Middle East? Appeared in the New York Times. We rarely hear about Christian militias fighting in this area.
That's because
write about them.
Yeah, they have to go to the market to buy their own guns, so they're doing.
The United States isn't arming them.
No, the United States is not arming them, and that makes some people are very critical of that. On the other hand, do you really want more armed militias running around Iraq? It's a question.
Aren't some Westerners going there to fight?
Yes.
We don't hear about that either.
You know, if you watched Fox News, you'd hear quite a lot about that.
Oh.
They.
Now I know why I should watch Fox News.
So small numbers of Westerners are going to Iraq and Syria to fight alongside these Assyrian militias. And they are going on their own. And the United States does not support their being there at all.
Part of the problem in all of this is that almost all of the different groups have been cited for human rights abuses. So it's hard to side with anyone.
It's hard.
Except the poor innocent civilians who are caught in the middle.
Sure, it's hard to side with anyone. But a negotiated political settlement is not difficult to foresee. Essentially, under the Iraqi constitution, the minorities would like to gather together and have their own protectorate. And that is actually possible and already has been in discussions in Iraqi parliament.
In the days before the invasion of Iraq, many people warned that this was opening a Pandora's box, that we would find ourselves with warring radicalized militias, ethnic cleansing, and regional destabilization. Have the worst predictions of 2003 all come true?
I don't think it could be much worse. I don't think we could see Iraqis suffering much more than they are now.
Do you see any solution? It seems almost unsolvable.
You know, as a reporter, I really try to stay away from that kind of more 30,000-foot question. What I was hearing many Iraqis calling for was, you know, an ability to split, that the idea of Iraq as a nation state is over, and we need to understand that in order to find any solution at all.
Is more U.S. involvement, airstrikes and training, likely to help?
You know, is more U.S. engagement likely to help? I'm an engagement proponent. So I would say that our careful attention to a negotiated space. Look, first, the problem is ISIS. We've got, again, we're looking at possibly a decade before ISIS goes anywhere. And what our engagement against ISIS should look like is a question for those who understand that better. But we must engage.
Joe Biden came under a lot of criticism in the past when he suggested that Iraq be broken up into different regions, Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish. Is that one of the solutions?
That's certainly one of the solutions Iraqis who I speak to would like.
And where would that leave the Christian minority?
What they'd like is they'd like their own territory under the Iraqi constitution as a – if you were looking at Iraq as the United States, essentially, what they'd like to be is a little state, which would give them the right to a budget and to arm themselves, to be part of a nascent National Guard.
So we would talk about whole new boundaries, mixing parts of Syria and Iraq?
That's
unlikely.
That's too big to get into in the scope of I can only report on what is happening now.
Well, you're right. Even if ISIS is defeated, the fate of religious minorities in Syria and Iraq remains bleak.
Absolutely. I mean, we are looking at numbers dwindling so quickly. People aren't just leaving because they're under pressure. They're also leaving because they're highly educated and they're highly mobile. So there are a lot of reasons that cause people to leave in such droves, but leaving, they are.
Well, you suggested that ISIS will be around for another decade now. Their hope is to create a caliphate over the entire Middle East. That's unlikely.
Let's hope it's unlikely. Let us hope that is unlikely.
But you're suggesting that it could be. Are people leaning in that direction?
I mean, they have taken us so by surprise. Their level of sophistication is so high. You can find people on every side. You can find informed people saying, you know, we can defeat them easily. They're not as strong as they look, or the opposite.
Eliza Griswold's article, Is This the End of Christianity in the Middle East?, appeared in the New York Times. It's always a pleasure having you on our show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.